Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them.
Disrespect welcomes Andy Rady, treasurer of the Criminal Lawyers Association. And you've been practicing in London. You said what? 27 years?
27 years.
Wow! Welcome to the show.
Pleased to be here.
I read in the paper recently about London joining the Criminal Lawyers Association. There's an easy word and there's a right word for this. It's a What are you calling it?
It's a boycott.
Yeah, the boycott of legal aid, because of the legal aid rates that are being paid to criminal lawyers. They're not even covering costs, apparently.
No, but if I can indicate, and to be clear, we're not boycotting all legal aid. We're boycotting taking retainers in cases that involve homicide or guns and gangs crimes, some of the more serious crimes out there. So we want to make sure that we're not, you know, indicating that we're leaving anyone really in the lurch.
Okay. Why did you pick those particular crimes to boycott?
Are they the most expensive? Those are the kinds of areas that people may notice if it's difficult to get a lawyer. And secondly, they're the kinds of crimes that if someone's charged and they have a difficult time getting a lawyer, that the lawyer may be able to bring an application to the court for funding beyond the legal aid tariff.
Oh. So how does that relate to the boycott?
Well, it relates to the boycott because essentially what we're saying is that the legal aid tariff in Ontario has fallen woefully behind what it should be.
At the legal aid offices along with it, too. Yeah.
Well, that's true. It's all of legal aid. It's never been the main player in the justice equation that gets any funding.
Right.
We've seen over the last 20 years or so serious increases to what is paid to the prosecution of cases in terms of, you know, what crown attorneys are paid, what judges are paid, police budgets have gone up. There have been all kinds of initiatives to create different kinds of courts, domestic violence courts, courts concerning Aboriginals, therapeutic or mental health courts. But there hasn't been any kind of a corresponding increase to the legal aid tariff, which is what is paid to lawyers, and not just the tariff which is paid to lawyers, but also what lawyers get paid to pay for experts in the important cases.
Right.
There's a very limited amount that can be paid for a lawyer to use the resources of say psychiatrists or investigators or other kinds of practitioners that may be important in the defense of a criminal case.
All right.
And consequently, it's been rather difficult to get experts to be able to testify to counter what, you know, the Crown may have. And their resources in that field are obviously much greater than what goes to the defense.
Yeah.
And there's a concern that, if this continues, a couple of things are going to happen. One, we're going to see miscarriages of justice because the accused person just cannot afford to, you know, fight a proper defense in their case. And that's probably the main concern. The other concern is that with lawyers not taking legal aid cases, these accused may just not be able to find lawyers to represent them, or at least lawyers who are of sufficient experience and seniority in doing these kinds of cases, such that that person will be on a level playing field. Because right now we're saying it's not a level playing field, and you can spend a lot of money on the prosecution side, but you have to spend it on the other side. However, that's really not an attractive thing politically in the current environment that we have. We're talking, every political party seems to talk about we have to be tough on crime and all these other initiatives, but no one really seems to say that we should be fair to the person who the state charges. And that's what we're trying to say, is there has to be some semblance of fairness there.
Absolutely. And I understand that the Crown attorneys, the so-called well-paid Crown attorneys, have come on your side.
They have, and that's very pleasing, because we've always been supportive, our association has, of the Crown attorneys over the years when they've gone to the government and sought to have increases so they can be adequately paid. But the difference, you see, between the Crowns and the defense bar is this, that we are a private bar. And yes, you can say people should be paying you out of their own pockets. Well, if they can, they have to. That's what our system says. If they have the means to pay a lawyer privately, they should, and they do. But it's those people who don't have that ability can't. And a lot of people who are charged with serious criminal offenses do not have that ability. The difficulty, of course, from the lawyer's point of view, the private lawyer's point of view, is this. They also have to run their office. They have to staff their office. They have to have, their assistants. They have to, get their stationery. They have to have their office space, that sort of thing. And that's expensive.
Yeah.
So that comes out of the amount of money we're paid by legal aid, whereas you see the Crown salaries, they have... There's no correlation between that and the number of staff in their offices or the police authorities or anything of that nature. So, yes, it might look on the surface that, at the highest legal aid rate, which right now for senior lawyers, that's lawyers with more than 10 years experience, is $96.95 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That may seem to be a lot, but when you take out the overhead expense, which in a lot of cases can get to be well more than even 50% of that, the amount being paid is not sufficient. And considering that the experts that we have to hire are also being paid at a lesser rate than they would pay be paid sort of privately if they were retained.
Apparently quite a bit lesser.
It limits that.
Quite a bit lesser, apparently.
Considerably.
Yeah. And then there's a cap on the hours you can spend, so if you feel the case needs more hours, those aren't paid at all.
That's correct. There is a cap on the hours that you can spend, and if you spend more, then essentially it's a... if we talk about pro bono work, there's almost obviously a pro bono element to legal aid. And I think what we're saying here is, look, we know the economic times are difficult, but we've had recessions in the last 20 years or so.
Yeah.
And we've had good times in the last 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
It never has seemed to be an appropriate time to seek a legal aid increase. And we've tried, we've sought this over the last number of years, and what we're trying to do is to try and to bring to public attention and the attention of the government that they cannot continue to underfund the legal aid plan. And there's other functions. It's not just the provincial government, but, there's money coming from the federal government to the Ontario Legal Aid. Money comes from the Law Foundation of Ontario to legal aid.
Right.
But still, there has to be an infusion at some point. Otherwise, we're going to have a great dilemma in our justice system of unfairness. And unfairness to those who cannot afford it, those who are most vulnerable, and we're going to have really a two-tier system of justice, those who can afford justice and those who can't. And that's either going to be important to people or it's not. And so in terms of, yes, is this the right time or the wrong time when we have issues concerning health care and education, obviously we are not blind to the economic dilemmas that the governments are being faced with right now. However, we've heard that before. This isn't the time. This isn't the time. And when it was the time, it wasn't the time either. So it's a long process of trying to educate just what is going on in our justice system, and that's one of our problems. A lot of people really do not understand how the justice system works.
You mean the adversarial nature and the funding requirements of the justice
system? The adversarial
system?
Nature and the funding requirements, and we see a lot of our justice system, of what we see in the media, what we read in the newspapers. We see about a sensational case, and it's human nature. You pass judgment on whether someone is guilty or not guilty from what you see in the paper. And if someone's guilty of something, why should we be paying for someone's defense when they did something that was so bad? Well, what we forget about, and what no one really seems to emphasize, is this lovely thing that we've had in our system since, it began, which is called the presumption of innocence.
Yeah.
And just because someone is charged by the police and just because the newspapers have, sensationalized the story about it, does not mean that the person is guilty. they have to be proven guilty in the courtroom. Yeah. And what we're saying is, if you have all of these resources of the state to bear on that individual who is being charged by the state, mm-hmm. then you also have to level the field and make sure that they can put forth a proper and adequate defense. If at the end of the day they're found guilty, well, the system has worked. But if at the end of the day they're found guilty and they were not able to actually put forth a serious defense in the matter because of proper funding, it shows a great bias in favor of the power of the state over the power of the individual citizen. And what we have to remember is that anybody out there at any time may be wrongfully charged with an offense and will have to defend themselves. It doesn't mean just because I'm a good person and I seem to be law-abiding that I'm not going to have to face the justice system at some point. It could happen to anyone.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and much of the expense is your own, regardless of whether you're found guilty or not.
That's true.
Yeah.
So and if you're found not guilty, there is no redress to go to the state to pay for legal fees in a criminal case.
No,
it doesn't
way.
Happen.
Oh, okay. So if they're not awarded, then that's the end of it.
No, for example, in a civil case where someone is suing someone else, there is a provision there for the winning party, so to speak, to get some of their costs paid by the losing party.
Mm-hmm.
But in a criminal case, someone who is found not guilty does not have that redress. Now, we've seen that in some of the more sensational cases where there have been horrendous miscarriages of justice for people who have gone to jail and spent several years charged with murder and found out that they're innocent, the after-the-fact DNA testing sort of thing.
Yeah.
But for the average Joe out there or the average person out there who might be charged with a less serious crime and found not guilty, there's no redress for them.
It's not just out of pocket.
They're out of pocket, no matter what they do. Now, that's not really a legal aid issue, but it's one of the issues that, as I say, people don't really understand.
Well, if you have no money in your pocket, it's a legal aid issue for sure. Because how can you be out of pocket when you don't have the money to start with?
Exactly.
And the money isn't provided for your defense, in effect.
But one of the big things we have to understand when we're looking at legal aid and other issues in the justice system is just because the person is charged with an offense doesn't mean that they are guilty of that. They are charged with that offense.
Yeah.
And it is for the state that charges them, that has these resources, to prove that they're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to. And I think we forget about that a lot, and we sort of think, oh, this is a bad person, we've read about them, this is a horrendous crime, and why are we paying for their defense? Well, we forget for a moment, we have to remember for a moment, they have not been found guilty yet. It's only been reported in the newspaper, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find you practice in Canada, but do you find a different attitude amongst colleagues in the States that they expect that the public is more supportive of the defendant's right to presumption of innocence? Or is it a uniquely sort of Canadian attitude, or is this a growing concern?
Oh, I think it's a growing concern everywhere, but the Americans are have their own unique problems in their own justice system.
Yes.
Their own sort of attitude towards legal aid with their undefended underfunded public defender system,
exactly.
Which ours is different from. In Canada,
yes.
You essentially, or at least in Ontario, I should say, you are entitled to try and get the lawyer of your choice.
Mm-hmm.
And if that lawyer is prepared to take your case under legal aid, then legal aid will pay that individual lawyer, as opposed to legal aid does not work that, you're charged with something and you're just given whatever lawyer is on the list.
Yeah.
We don't have that. So that's a very good benefit of our system, this concept of choice, which we want to see continue as well.
Yeah. I understand Chris Bentley is rumored to be entertaining reducing the privileges of certificate law where you can choose your own lawyer?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether he's contemplating that or not. I don't think that's something that I have heard that's coming out of the Attorney General's office.
Was suggested in the paper, again.
Mr. Bentley practiced criminal defense law in London for a number of years under the certificate system and is a great advocate of our right to choice of counsel. But obviously he's in a different position now as Attorney General. Hopefully he will remember, and I think he does, what our system is all about in this province.
So you think maybe London coming on stream with this boycott might have a disproportionate effect in bringing this to the attention of a practicing London lawyer who's now in cabinet?
No, I think that... our Attorney General is fully aware of the problem, and he's, you know, I think he's trying to work at it in his own way. I know that he's thinks that the boycott is not helpful politically to try and achieve whatever ends that they're trying to achieve. And I think what we're saying is, well, we may appreciate that. All we're trying to do is that this goes beyond just, you know, the politics of it. We would like, you know, sort of the citizens of the province, the voters, to know that this is a real and serious issue and should not just be considered to be something secondary, because the administration of justice is very important. And it's very important that people who are innocent of crimes not be found guilty, and that they be able to, you know, provide an adequate defense to their cases. And, you know, I'll say this, and it sounds like, you know, blowing the horn of defense lawyers. Defense lawyers have done just that. You know, they have been part of this system for a long period of time, and they've given a lot that way. The public may not see it, but that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And it's just now sort of a reckoning is coming when we can see, because we're in the system every day, knowing the disparities that are occurring, and that if they continue to occur, because things take a long time to unfold, that we're going to see the problem of young lawyers not wanting to do criminal defense work.
I understand you're already seeing it.
We are seeing that. You know, there's a great graying of the bar that we see, and younger lawyers are going to go to more lucrative areas of the law than criminal defense work.
Right.
And it's difficult if you don't have those younger lawyers, you don't have the sort of the money in the system to mentor them as they come along. Now, again, you can say in the private world, you know, that should happen. But what we have to remember is that criminal law isn't just a private situation. It's not like someone, person A suing some person B, or it's not between those individuals. This is a case where there are two parties involved. One is the individual, but the other is the state.
Yeah. So you have limited power against almost infinite power.
One might suggest that.
Yeah. It seems that the problem comes out of a kind of electoral point of view, and you haven't obviously taken a political point of view of this action, because if you had, you would have done this closer to the election, and the election is still a long way away. So you're hoping to resolve the problem, from the look of it, before the election comes out. But the problem, as you mentioned, it seems to be a kind of NIMBY attitude. It's like, not my concern. This does, you know, this isn't relevant in my backyard. Take these nasty people away. I won't have any of these people today, kind of thing.
It is, and it's beyond being political. I mean, we're not espousing one political point of view or another. And frankly, you know, the administration of justice is more important than, you know, a political issue.
Right.
It's really grassroots, and that's what we would like. We would like to have more understanding.
Yeah.
That it is very important, and we don't usually think about it unless, ourselves or someone we know is, you know, facing, you know, that problem with being charged with an offense.
Yeah.
We don't think about it, or we, you know, we read the sensational stories in the newspaper and make comment on them, and we like to, you know, get involved or understand it that way. But from, you know, the true perspective, there's a great distortion as to what the administration of justice is about, as is determined either by the media or what you see on TV or in the movies, as to what really occurs in the real world to the individuals who are facing it.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it's not like a TV show at all when you're
not
involved in it. Yeah. Is there anything that we haven't addressed that you would like to address about this issue before, you know, we look to wrapping up the interview?
Well, I don't want to be repetitive, but I mean, I think the thing about the issue that's important is to know that it goes beyond political boundaries. It goes to the root of our justice system in this province. We've had a great system that was built up, you know, in the late 60s concerning legal aid in Ontario. We want to see that continue. This is not just an issue about lawyers lining their pockets, but it's like saying, you know, if you don't provide for the defense as you would for the prosecution, we are not going to have a fair playing field. And what we believe that most of the citizens think is that we should have a fair playing field when it comes to criminal justice, and it's just not there. So, I mean, that's really the issue that we're trying to get at, is to show that it hasn't been funded properly for a long time. There have been some minor increases when things have gotten to critical level, but what we're saying is we're getting to critical level again if we're not there already, and we have to look to the future. And unfortunately, you know, the economic timing may be bad, but it's always bad. And it's something that we have to look at more than just saying we must get tough on crime and we must put it all in all these resources to the prosecution side. We have to look at it, you know, from a clear perspective otherwise.
Do you have any last-minute advice for someone who can't find a lawyer in a criminal matter?
Continue to look. Try, you know, there are applications to the court for the appointment of counsel. Those have been fairly rare.
Okay.
But it's a scary world for those individuals, I would think. There was an old phrase that any lawyer who represents himself in court has got an idiot for a client. Our criminal justice system has become too complicated for an individual to be there representing themselves without counsel. It does occur, sometimes successfully, but more often than not, they are not going to get a fair shake. And just to keep trying to find a lawyer if they can, and to show that they should, you know, get the support of people out there that, you know, again, we're innocent until proven guilty, and we have to keep fighting that fight.
Thank you for that message. I appreciate your time today, and we'll put it out on tomorrow, actually, at noontime at 93.3 FM.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Reedy.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to London criminal lawyer Andrew Reedy talk about the legal aid boycott and its influence on people who are disadvantaged. And now a break with Forrest Sykes plays the boogie. Disrespects Review of the News, published in the newspaper up until Tuesday, August 25th. These are excerpts from the news. They are not the full articles. For the Spectator, we regret that unless you're a subscriber, you won't be able to access these articles on the web. And even if you can, after the day of their publication, they are archived under different keywords that don't always bring up the material. They're excerpts for the Globe. Go onto the web, find the full news story using the writer and the title that we give you on our review. Food donation crisis, Friday, August 14th, Hamilton Spectator. Salvation Army's cupboard is bare and demand up 30%. People are lining up for food in the front room of the Salvation Army's Bay Street Depot. In the back room, volunteers have nothing to put in the bags. That's why Hamilton Salvation Army is pleading for help. There's a 30% increase in people asking the agency for food at a time when donations have slumped. Rising need in the city has left food supplies dangerously low, says Major Ken Percy. Said Adam Spence of the Ontario Association of Food Banks, "We're facing tough times in Ontario and food banks are struggling to keep up with demand." He said, "We need all the help we can get." Hamilton residents can support the campaign in person at the Ottawa Street Farmers Market by dropping off their donation at the Ontario Association of Food Banks, Buy Local, Share Local booth. And that by John Berman. From the Globe's reporter Andre Picard, public health reporter in Saskatoon, "Poor economy hammers health of Canadians," survey shows. Respondents spending less on food, exercise, and prescriptions. The economic downturn is delivering a beating to Canadians' health as well as their wealth, the new poll shows. The survey commissioned by the Canadian Medical Association shows that while 57% of Canadians are worried about their financial security, an almost equal number, 52%, are worried about their health. That is almost twice as many as 27% of those polled who are worried about losing their jobs. And many Canadians, especially those in lower income brackets, are cutting corners with their health to make ends meet. Emerson said famously that the greatest wealth is health, said Dr. Robert Ouellette, president of the Canadian Medical Association. This year, the CMA's report card shows that these tough economic times could also be a serious health hazard for Canadians. Residents of Ontario, Alberta, and BC gave the highest number of A grades for their health systems and the government's handling of the health file. The provinces, for their part, garnered 43% A or B grades, up from 40% in 2008. Ontario and Alberta residents were the most pleased with the performance of their governments, while Quebecers were the least pleased. Canadians are almost evenly divided between pessimists and optimists when it comes to predicting the future of health care delivery. The full results of the CMA report card are available at www.cma.ca/report-card-htm. That's www.cma.ca/report-card.htm. And in the Star, August 19th, by Nate Laurie, an opinion piece, "Broken Welfare System Punishes Provinces Poor." Ontario doesn't work for the rising tide of unemployed people who don't qualify for EI. Ontario Works, the new name that former Ontario Premier Mike Harris gave to local social assistance, is one of the cruelest ironies left over from his assault on the province's most vulnerable residents. People who can't find work because there aren't any available jobs are called the unemployed. And as the accompanying chart showed, their numbers have exploded in this devastating recession. As of June, the number of unemployed is up 34% from just 7 months earlier. Ontario isn't working for them. Because they tend to be poor to start with, the welfare system says, in effect, that they should be even poorer when they are deprived of work. The level of social assistance they receive leaves them far below the poverty line. And therein lies the real problem. Because we accept poverty as a fact of life, just as we accept a growing disparity in the distribution of income, we countenance wholly inadequate levels of welfare benefits that push people far below the poverty levels of the working poor. Until we get serious about tackling overall poverty in a meaningful way, the welfare system will simply not be fixed. However unjustified, our welfare system is but an extension of our acceptance of deep and widespread poverty. Also from the Spectator's Canada and World News, a Canadian press report, ailing blind granny forced to leave Canada. Toronto, a blind grandmother was forced to leave Toronto and return to her native Poland after living in Canada for 11 years. Stefania Elzbieta Magdziak arrived on a tourist visa in 1998 to visit her son and daughter, but never left. The 69-year-old says she applied to stay in the country under humanitarian and compassionate grounds, but had her case denied. Magdziak was booked on a flight from Pearson Airport. Her daughter says there aren't enough medical or social services in Poland to take care of the beloved family matriarch, who will be traveling to her hometown of Rin, 300 kilometers north of Warsaw. Tuesday, August 25th, Spectator, by John Berman again, ER doctor charged with sexual assault. An emergency room physician who trained and practiced in Hamilton has been charged with sexually assaulting a disabled patient and criminal harassment of a classmate at McMaster University. Dr. Justin Fuminori Onzuka, 36, of Mississauga, was arrested while visiting friends in Hamilton Saturday. Police allege Onzuka administered a noxious thing to incapacitate a disabled female patient in 2005. Onzuka is not currently practicing medicine. He is in custody and will appear in Hamilton Court Thursday for a bail hearing. And that's today for you listening. His license has been under suspension by the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons since May 7, 2008, pending the outcome of a hearing by the college's Fitness to Practice Committee. No date has been set for the hearing. Detective Helena Russell of the Hamilton Police Sexual Assault Unit said the charges followed an intense week-and-a-half investigation after police received information regarding alleged historical sexual assaults investigators believe date back to 1994. The investigation is ongoing, and police are hoping to hear from any potential victims. Police have asked anyone with information to call Detective Helena Russell at 905-540-5544 or Crime Stoppers if they wish to remain anonymous at 1-800-222-8477. From the Globe and Mail, Wednesday, August 19th, BC woman arrested in autistic boy's death. A 42-year-old woman from Grand Forks, BC, has been arrested in connection with the death of a 12-year-old autistic boy whose body was found just three doors down from his home. RCMP said that Kimberly Ruth Noyes was taken without incident at around 3:50 p.m. local time. According to spokesman Corporal Dan Moskaluk, she was found after a 911 call from an alert citizen reporting that Ms. Noyes had been spotted near a local secondary school. Ms. Noyes became the subject of a search after the body of John David Fulton was found in her residence in the Gables community. The boy, who was a high-functioning autistic, vanished on Saturday from the front steps of his home. Ms. Noyes has been arrested in conjunction with the murder of John Fulton, said Corporal Moskaluk yesterday, adding that the investigation will continue. After the arrest, the Fulton family released a statement to the media, according to the CBC, thanking the police but also chastising them for not issuing an Amber Alert. We would like to express our concern with the lack of an Amber Alert in this investigation. We do not know if this could have saved Johnny's life, nor do we wish to speculate. However, we feel strongly that any child with autism should automatically qualify as an Amber Alert, the release said. Corporal Moskaluk said police did everything they could, noting initial searches after John went missing ran through the night and into the next morning. Still, he acknowledged that the end result in this case is the worst turn of events a file can take. He said the basics of the case did not initially fit with the criteria for issuing an Amber Alert, including a belief that the victim had been abducted. And from the Globe and Mail by Michael McDonald in Halifax, system failed tasered man, doctor tells inquiry. The first doctor to see Howard Hyde after he'd been tasered up to five times during a struggle with Halifax police told a fatality inquiry yesterday he believes the system failed the mentally ill man. Stephen Curry, an emergency room doctor at the QE2 Health Sciences Center, said he became upset when he learned Mr. Hyde had died during a struggle with jail guards about 30 hours after he was discharged from the hospital on November 21, 2007. During his testimony, he was asked if he agreed that the system had failed Mr. Hyde because he did not get the psychiatric care he needed after he left the hospital. "Yes," Dr. Curry said. "Yes, I do." Again, from the Globe and Mail, fallout from the Braidwood inquiry, Ian Bailey, the reporter in Vancouver. The Braidwood inquiry's lawyer is rejecting allegations of bias in a motion by Taser International Incorporated that seeks to quash findings by the probe into police taser use. The stun gun manufacturer based in Scottsdale, Arizona, followed through with a pledge to file a motion in BC Supreme Court seeking to quash findings last month made on the safety of tasers as part of a first phase report by Thomas Braidwood, a retired justice of the BC Appeal Court. The company alleges bias by the inquiry's commissioner, its lawyer, and a medical expert. "I have every confidence the courts will sort this out," Art Vertlieb, lawyer for the inquiry, said in an interview yesterday. No date has been set for a court hearing to deal with the submission, the second attempt to seek judicial intervention in the work of the inquiry after lawyers for four Mounties sought to head off Mr. Braidwood's ability to find fault in their conduct in dealing with Robert Sikansky. That bid was rejected by the BC Supreme Court. The 40-year-old Polish immigrant died on October 14, 2007, after a confrontation at Vancouver International Airport with the police, drawn to the scene because Mr. Sikansky was acting erratically. Mr. Sikansky was subjected to about 20 seconds of taser blasts. He died of cardiac arrest. The Globe and Mail, Wednesday, August 19th. By Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter for the Globe. Ontario Legal Aid Plan faces $56 million deficit. The Ontario Legal Aid Plan faces a staggering $56 million budget shortfall, a funding crisis that comes as it is already reeling from a boycott by senior criminal lawyers. In an internal memorandum obtained by the Globe and Mail, Legal Aid Ontario President and Chief Executive Officer Robert Ward warned that the impact of the deficit promises to be, quote, very significant, and will soon necessitate a cash infusion unless quick action is taken. The memo, written on April 9, 2009, ascribed $40 million of the shortfall to a precipitous drop in funding this year from the Law Foundation of Ontario, which gives Legal Aid Ontario interest payments that accumulate on its trust accounts, which are administered by lawyers. CEO Ward predicted that it will be, quote, several years before revenues from the Law Foundation rebound. His memo sketched out several options for cutting or modifying services to legal aid clinics, courthouse duty counsel, and a certificate program that allows clients to retain lawyers. The Association of Legal Aid Lawyers, representing 450 people who work as staff lawyers or duty counsel in the province's 77 legal aid clinics, reacted angrily yesterday to the probability of severe service cuts. Association of Legal Aid Lawyers Chairman Walter Vandeklute said that government funding has failed to keep pace with inflation over the past two decades, a pattern that threatens the entire program. "Now we are learning there are plans to impose so-called efficiencies to the program," Mr. Vandeklute said. "They want to rationalize legal services, which is business speak for degrading existing funding. Just when the poor and unemployed need a hand up, they're getting a slap down." The erosion of the legal aid program has been decried recently by a broad spectrum of the justice system, including the Ontario Crown Attorneys Association, the majority of the Criminal Lawyers Association, and Hugh Locke, a prominent former judge of the Ontario Supreme Court. August 15th, the Globe and Mail. Swine flu patient dies weeks after giving birth. Infected mother's condition worsened after her baby was born and she died without ever having held him. By Ingrid Peretz in Montreal. A young mother described as a ball of joy died yesterday. Friday, August 14th in Montreal after contracting the H1N1 virus, leaving behind a baby boy she never lived to see. Fatia Idrissi Kaituni was taken to hospital in early June complaining of a sore throat and fever. She was 2 weeks away from giving birth to her first child. Within days, the 23-year-old woman developed pneumonia and was rushed to another hospital where doctor delivered her baby by emergency cesarean section. The baby, Yassine, survived and is healthy, but his mother's condition plummeted. She was placed on life support to assist her breathing and died without regaining consciousness or holding her son in her arms. A spokeswoman for the Quebec health industry said Ms. Idrissi Kaituni was the 24th confirmed death caused by H1N1. in the province. Gaston Dessert, a medical epidemiologist at Laval University in Quebec City, said the risk of complications for women is greater in the second half of their pregnancy. Women with flu symptoms should quickly consult a doctor, as prompt antiviral treatment is vital. The effectiveness depends on the speed with which you start treatment, he said. This is Van Walls. We'll take a break now with Supermarket Baby.
Supermarket baby, go shopping all the time. Supermarket baby, go shopping all the time. I don't care how big she gets, she's buying all mine. When she hits that market, all the clerks run in fear. When she hits that market, all the clerks run in fear. They all start yelling, supermarket babies, yeah.
And a difficult story to edit on the fly here, but flus are needed to battle pandemic, CMA Journal. Tuesday, August 18th in the Globe and Mail, half a page by Carolyn Alfonso Toronto and Andre Picard, Saskatoon. Canadians need an independent flu czar who can cut across borders and compel provinces to follow orders in fighting the swine flu pandemic this fall, according to the country's leading medical journal. The position of a national health leader would have more sweeping powers than those of Canada's Chief Public Health Officer, David Butler-Jones, who can provide guidance, not directives. And it would require provinces to loosen their hold on the health file during emergencies, something they would likely be reluctant to do. Polly Baer, editor-in-chief of the Canadian Medical Association Journal, said yesterday, that was Monday, August 17th, that the Tsar would have the power to quickly move equipment and healthcare staff between provinces in the event the H1N1 pandemic turns more sinister this fall. Healthcare delivery and drugs would be consistent in every jurisdiction. Health Minister Leona Aglukkaq, speaking yesterday at the Canadian Medical Association conference in Saskatoon, refused to answer any questions about the CMAJ's call for a health czar. Dr. Eber said the role of Dr. Butler-Jones could be re-engineered to give him more independence and legislative powers in an emergency. He's doing his very best. He's developing consensus. He's got guidance on many major public health policies. He's advising the minister. All of those things are being done. The only thing that's not going to be done is if it really matters and decisions have to be made quickly, all he can do is call a teleconference and get everybody to agree, Dr. Eber said. The Public Health Officer of Canada's role at this point is to work at the pleasure of the minister, so there's no independence from the minister. This is not the first time the issue of independence at the Public Health Agency of Canada has come up. Dr. Butler-Jones was asked about it at an emergency Parliamentary Health Committee meeting. On things that really matter, I'm not easily muzzled, he responded. Liberal health critic Carolyn Bennett said the idea of a flu czar seems like a good one, but with one important caveat. There is no point in appointing a new person if they have no responsibility of power, and there doesn't seem to be much appetite for that from the Prime Minister's office. Also from the Globe and Mail subsequently, Public Health by Gloria Galloway in Ottawa, logjam in vaccine packaging to delay H1 flu shots. Let's try that again. Logjam in vaccine packaging to delay H1N1 flu shots. Canadians will wait for vaccinations against pandemic H1N1 influenza even as bulk vaccine shipments are exported to other countries because GlaxoSmithKline can produce more vaccine at its Quebec plant than it can put into vials. U.S. health officials recognized this week that a similar problem would slow the rollout of the vaccine to Americans and began hunting for factories that can get more of the liquid into vials quicker. But despite the limited capacity of its fill line in Ste. Foy, Quebec, the pharmaceutical company with the sole contract to produce pandemic flu vaccine for Canadians is not looking for help to package the drug for domestic distribution. When asked repeatedly whether another Canadian pharmaceutical manufacturer would be approached to provide assistance, GlaxoSmithKline would state only that it is living up to its agreement with Canada. Canada has ordered 50 million doses from GSK, a long-standing contract that requires delivery as quickly as possible, a company official said. GSK has allocated 20% of the vaccine produced at the Canadian manufacturing site to developing countries. That includes a proposed donation of 50 million doses to the World Health Organization. But the company refuses to explain where the bulk shipments from the Ste. Foy plant will go. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has long predicted it would have 120 million doses on hand by October 15th, but now expects just 45 million by that date because of the packaging delays. In Canada, the Ste. Foy facility will begin producing vaccine in November or possibly late October, and it will be Christmas before every Canadian who wants a shot can get one. It takes 2 weeks for the vaccine to be considered fully effective, and many people will require more than one shot, which means it will be February or even March before the vaccine is protecting all of the Canadians who are inoculated. That's well after the traditional flu season begins in December. John Treanor, a vaccine expert at the University of Rochester in New York, said even November could be too late for the vaccinations to start. The experience in the U.S. last summer, early spring, seemed to be that a lot of the flu activity at least started in schools and it went away when school was over. So if you follow that logic, you might be concerned that the next wave of this could start up when kids go back to school very shortly, Dr. Treanor said. And that makes the vaccine delay a little more important because it could mean, at least in the beginning, your first response to any upsurge in activity will not include the vaccine because it would not be available. Again, the Globe and Mail, Chinta Puxley in Winnipeg. Manitoba's natives, pregnant women get priority for flu drug. The province that experienced an acute outbreak of swine flu on its northern reserves is making it easier for Aboriginals and other vulnerable patients to get free antiviral drugs in a bid to lessen the impact of the virus come fall. Manitoba has set out who can get Tamiflu more quickly under its PharmaCare program. The groups include Aboriginals, those with underlying medical conditions, pregnant women, smokers, and obese people. Homeless people and those with immune deficiencies, including cancer patients, will also get priority. The changes which will make it easier for doctors to prescribe Tamiflu quickly were set out in a regulation that takes effect August 18th. People who don't meet the medical criteria can still buy a prescription for Tamiflu, but it may not be covered by the province. Under the old system, doctors had to justify each prescription, which involved phone calls, faxes, and paperwork. Provincial Health Minister Teresa Oswald said her government wants to make sure that those who need the antivirals get them quickly. David Harper, chief of the Garden Hill First Nation in the affected area, said he's not counting on any level of government. While he said the province might be making it easier for some Aboriginals to get antivirals, it doesn't matter much to remote communities that don't have drugstores. He added his community of 4,000 received just 154 doses of Tamiflu during the last outbreak. He's soliciting corporate donations to buy antivirals and other medical supplies. "We have no choice in the matter," Mr. Harper said. "They can have all the Tamiflu sitting in Winnipeg, but when it comes to preparedness, we need Tamiflu throughout the North." And from the Globe and Mail again recently, "Inuit Fear Impact of Flu Pandemic" by Bill Curry in Iqaluit. "By now, the high-risk groups are well known. Swine flu is bad news for pregnant women and youth, and like other viruses, it spreads easily among people in close quarters. What has Inuit leaders worried is that this describes a good number of their people. Inuit are young, have high pregnancy rates, and many live in small homes jam-packed with multiple families. As Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his senior ministers sat down for a cabinet committee meeting in Iqaluit, the people in the area will be among those who fear that they will be hit hardest should the virus arrive as expected in the fall. Nunavut Premier Eva Ariak and Nunavut MP Leona Aglukak greeted ministers of the Priorities and Planning Committee and the Prime Minister in the Evening Sun of the Far North on the airport tarmac. After their three-hour flight from Ottawa, jackets were not required, and a light breeze provided a welcome contrast to the humid heat of Ottawa. Ms. Glukak, who's hosting the Prime Minister, did not make herself available for an interview. Her spokeswoman, Jose Belmer, offered an email statement on the minister's behalf. "The development of a pandemic plan for a territory or province rests with the territory or provincial government. However, the agency is available to provide support and guidance as requested and required," Ms. Belmer wrote. "The Public Health Agency of Canada and Health Canada are working with our territorial and provincial partners to find the best course of action to meet the needs of each region to address H1N1, including Inuit communities." That's it for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. On a lighter note, we'll be celebrating September 5th, the greatest euphemism of all time, International Bacon Day. And now, a little music to take us out. Omar and the Howlers, "Girls Got Rhythm."
Go! No.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.